Hi, this is Bill Himes, and I'm listening to the Prairie Brass Band and going to listen with great interest to Go.
So you're ready? Get set. Go!
Entertaining start. Make sure when you get to letter B, those chords and the horns and baritones, euphonium, etc., tubas settle in right from the very first note. Like we lost a little tempo going into E, like 2 bars before. Of course, it doesn't help when she throws in a 5/4 bar just for fun. Nice job on the ride solo there. Maynard Ferguson would be proud. Nice job there, trombone section, letter I. Get a little loose there in the cornet's 4/4 key. Don't lose your groove. A nice convincing finish there. That's a very entertaining opener. Congratulations.
Go by Lucy Pankhurst, who's going to get this fall player still with the wing edge tenderness band and the few studying composition at our law and all the point of music. She first came to the notice of the Prairie Brass Band in 2006. When she was commissioned to write a piece for them to play on the Inter-Africa CD, an aid of the World Vision Caliphate of Ethiopian Relief. Prairie Brass Band were the only non-English brass band to get onto the CD, and you can still buy copies of it here. It all goes to a great charity. And we move now from that to opera. I guess it's fair to say that despite being one of the great opera composers of all time, and a man who wrote opera after opera after opera, all of which were great successes, that his greatest success originally wasn't the Barber of Seville. When he gave his first performance at the Teatro Argentina in Rome, all sorts of things went wrong. And apparently, the audience spent most of the evening convulsing laughter at the stupid things that were going on stage. Even amazingly, they offered me, when they came to do the offer for the second time, they'd lost the overture. And the overture that you heard earlier, that was for the Rossini's opera, The Barber of Seville, wasn't actually the opera. The overture that was written for that opera, it was written for an opera called Aureliana. And then he wrote another opera called Elizabeth, the Queen of England, and he couldn't afford to write an overture for that, so he used the overture for Aureliana. And then when they'd lost the original overture for Barbara Seville, he used that same overture again. So if you look back into the Rossini's workbook, as it were, that he used the same overture for three different operas. He knew what was good in this Rossini. The opera of the Barber of Seville, the barber, is Figaro. And Figaro is, of course, the same man who Mozart used in The Marriage of Figaro. What's amazing is that despite the fact that Mozart's opera predated Rossini's opera by, I guess, 100 years, that they come from, it's the same story, but Mozart took the second part of the story, and Rossini took the original part of the story when Figaro was indeed a barber in Seville. But what he did, of course, more than anything else, he wasn't just the barber, he was the man who could fix anything. I don't even know whether he could give you a decent shave or a decent haircut, but he was the factotum. And Figaro could fix anything. You wanted a woman, he could fix it. You wanted to get married, he could fix it. You wanted to buy a house, he could find a house for you. I guess if you'd had motor cars there, you would have even bought a second-hand car from Mr. Figaro. Rossini introduces the man with a great, great fanfare. It's a wonderful piece of music that is one of the most famous opera arias of all time. Today, the Fairy Brass Band have got their own factotum. So to play the Lago al Factotum from the Barber of Seville, please welcome Paul Easley.
Effective entry, Paul, sort of singing your solo across the stage. To my ear, the accompaniment is heavy. What you are playing right now is pretty much equal to the soloist. And I know it's hard to know the acoustics of a hall when you're just coming into play, but even like the timpani is carrying more than you'd think. Part of it, I suppose, is because I'm sitting in the balcony, I get a little bit more reflection. But then I can hear the euphonium easier, too, than probably the people in class. But listen to the recording of this performance, the one without me talking. And see if you don't find the same thing, that the band is just a little bit too heavy under him. Where the solo cornet really needs to be playing more into the band and into the stand, so the solo who's playing an octave below you is more pronounced. Well, I Watch out, though, it's a nation there. There's somebody's fighting with the soloists on that G-Flat concert. Is a little bit hard to follow because it's split two settings per page. When you go for those pedals there, make sure there's no vibrato because it'll wobble around on you otherwise. Just pedals always have to be played very straight. Job on the octaves there, on the soloists. Again, the timpani is really quite pronounced there. Basically, the timpani should be a tuba there. The accompaniment's awfully heavy here for the solos to come through. The tempo's quite ambitious, and it works out quite well. Well, it's a very pleasing solo, very exciting. Congratulations, Paul. Nicely done.
October before region, I have to ask you, would you buy a used car from this man? There were three kinds of composers that existed in Russia. There were the composers like Shostakovich, who were constantly a thorn in the side of authority. And Stalin simply hated Shostakovich, and it's coloured virtually everything that Shostakovich wrote until Stalin died. There were the guys that nobody cared about, like Goedicke, and everything that Goedicke had written is just sort of gone. And then on the other side, there were composers who really were communists, supported the regime, and did everything they could to sort of project socialism into society through culture. One of those was Khachaturian, and of course it meant that for many, many years, his music, even though it was an Armenian, the Russians really supported Khachaturian's music to such an extent that he wrote a great ballet that everybody thinks is somehow now is a great, wonderful sort of ballet about life, a glorious life in Russia, very happy music, things like the Saber Dance, was actually on the ballet is on a farm. It's on a farm that is run by the government, and it's everybody there is working for peanuts. Well, they're not working for peanuts, it's a cotton farm. And the best thing that happens, the most exciting thing that happens in the whole thing is when the corrupt people who are running the government-owned farm set fire to the warehouse so that they can make an insurance claim on it. So much for socialism being good for you. But it kept Aaron Khachaturian in the living. The music is glorious, and Howard Snell has put together a wonderful suite of music from this ballet, which he calls simply a Khachaturian suite. This is the wonderful finale, Lishinka.
Thank you.
job on that flowing melody and the solo front and the horns. The melody's nice and clean and clear. It's a letter B. I think it's important that the rolling part of the cornets needs to be less so that the melody comes through without effort in the third and flugel, etc., and euphonium. Sure about those triplets and rhythmically 61 62. It gets a little faded in the score there. Sort of adding a bonus note to the slurs there in the cornets. I'm thinking about two bars before J, where the run leading up to that is ending on a slur rather than tugging the downbeat of the bar two before J, etc., etc. It just cleans it up a little bit. Nice job, euphonium, digging out those high C sharps there along with the third and flugel and third bar of letter L. It can be a very challenging note to pick out. Lots of playing going on there in terms of lots of challenging stuff, and it's really sort of easy to let the wind get knocked out of you in the last three bars, which really need to be. Finally now, the whole band comes together with one unified rhythm with the percussion driving it through. I think you'll hear on the recording the last three bars actually lost a little bit of intensity. And in fact, it really needs to be quite powerfully marked and played quite aggressively to let people know it's truly over. But nice job on this very technical piece, but you've worked out the inner workings of those rolling triplets quite well.
They were written to go into musical reviews, musical films, most of which have died, some of which contain an incredible number of great songs. One such was written in 1937 by Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart, called Babes in Arms. It was even filmed in 1939 with Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney. And I guess if I ask you to put your hands up, anybody who has seen that film or can remember it, I never did, so I wonder how many of you have seen it as well. But this musical was just full of great songs. The Ladies of Paris, Where Are When, My Funny Valentine, which apparently is the favourite song of Dante, Dallas's wife, and he will be in great trouble tonight because they're not going to play that one today. However, today's choice will be familiar to everyone. It's a new arrangement by Dallas, especially for today. It's fantastic. Johnny, 1 minute.
Euphonium on that very high melody. We pull it off with a really good aplomb there. Nice job, soprano.
Mm-hmm.
job on the part of the soprano and the whole cornet section of this high stuff. Appreciated the dynamic contrast all the way down to mezzo piano in the middle of that. Probably need a dynamic marking of 121, Dallas. I'm not sure how far out that crescendo is supposed to come out to, but it's usually missing in the score. That's a nice tight chart. Another suggestion at the very end is that because of the acoustics of this room, percussion seems to travel quite well here. Maybe a little bit less percussion on the final bar, only so we can hear that unison in the rest of the band. But very nice arrangement.
I was going to say, it's a terrible moment when you announce the tune and you turn around and walk off and you find that your normal way off is blocked. Worse still, you find it's blocked by a drummer. Worse still, you find that if you try and get past, he's going to play the drums as loud as he possibly can. And you understand that as a conductor, we position ourselves usually as far away as we can from the percussion section. That's not what we don't like, though, it's that we value our hearing. However, we managed to get away unscathed. There's a great tradition in your country, rather than brass bands, which are a fairly new tradition, but of the wind band. And one of the leaders was a man called Roger Nixon. Roger was one of the great California-based composers. Studied, actually, with an Englishman, one Arthur Brisky was over here during the war years. He studied at what you quaintly call the University College Berkeley, which we in England would call the University College Barclay. How we in England get to pronounce B-E-R-K, Bark, when it's clearly should be B-A-R-K, and you pronounce it Burke, and we think you're odd. I don't know. But there we are, it's one of those quaint little things about our language. He studied at Berkeley, and was a great writer. He wrote literally hundreds of things for the wind band. This is one of his early compositions, and it's been rescored for brass band, especially for today, by Dallas. This is Roger Nixon's Fanfare March.
I hear the 16th notes much better at bar 12 than I do at the very beginning. Could be something of the voicing, I don't know. Seem awfully fierce that bar 53, which is marked forte, it sounded just as strong as bar 51. I guess overall what I'm saying here is I could do with a little more distinction between forte and fortissimo. It's a very exciting march. And the transcription seems to come off very well, Dallas. Congratulations. Spot where two bars before 110, that piano could be much softer. It comes off almost as mezzo forte. And that would leave room for the euphonium to do some crescendo without having to work too hard. Soprano's quite pronounced in this little obligato here, partly just because of the extreme range. You might want to consider muting him a little bit sooner. Nice inner working in the cornets there after 150 with the looks like Repiano on second. The euphonium was a little bit more in the background than I think should be at bar 167, your interplay with what's going on with the solo cornets. Again, the articulation at bar 199, 201, especially down in, looks like it's a euphonium, just needs to be very, very double-tongued to pull that off. Use a little more oomph on that crescendo at 240, so it really ends on a fortissimo right on that eighth note. That melody really needs to float along in the euphonium, flugel, etc., through all those wide octave leaps. But they shouldn't sound like changes from note to note, but just a nice melody that flows as though you're playing it on a keyboard rather than a valve instrument. That's a very challenging work, and band pulls it off. It's always a challenge getting those woodwind bits to work for cornets, but sopranos and solos getting a much-deserved applause for your work, particularly around 90 and thereabouts. It reminded me a lot of the Prokofiev Opus 99, just that angularity of that, that sort of legato line. It's a nice march.
The big hit from the movie score was called The Gale. It was actually little more than an arrangement of a tune by the Scottish fiddler. That in English means someone who plays the violin, not someone who fortifies his income tax returns. A Scottish fiddler called Dewey MacLean. Dewey is passionate in his support for Scottish independence, along with another great Scottish resident of California, Sean Connery. It's easy to be independent if you're rich. However, Andrew Duncan's arrangement draws more on Dewey MacLean's tune than Trevor Jones' film arrangement, and is, in a word, stunning. The Gale.
Euphonium basses could do with a little more crescendo into that forte, and close check of your intonation as you get louder, because it sort of blows apart a little bit. Opinion that once that percussion line is established, to get back off a little bit once the other lines come in, particularly a bass drum. Again, it's mainly an anomaly this hall with the low frequencies do so well, so you don't need to work quite so hard on it. It's a nice sonority the band's getting there, nicely balanced in your chords.
reason we're at a bit of a loss here is we have to score page 9, but we don't have 10 or 11, so we're kind of in the dark here. These crescendos are really kind of an overstatement. Well, this is kind of a nuance. You want to make sure that as you crescendo in the horns, you don't lose the darkness of your sound. Seeing anything louder than mezzo piano by indication is just sort of adding instruments to it. And I think what's upping the ante here is that, again, the percussion's a bit loud for mezzo piano, and that sort of forces everyone else to come up on their line. But I don't. That crescendo right now, to me, at letter D, sounds like it's a good forte, especially in the percussion, when in fact you're only mezzo forte. So all you have to do is just come in and you'll achieve a dynamic increase just because he's adding more people, but I don't think you need to work too hard here. That spot there, too, before E, in the second, thirds, and sopranos, fairly harsh and bright for a forte. It sounds really more fortissimo to me. Listen on the recording, see if it doesn't hit you the same way. Because you got the fortissimo coming up here. That letter F doesn't really sound appreciably louder, when in fact that's what you need to hold in reserve for this. Melody is actually in the horns and the euphonium, and then everything should be geared to that, but it's really sort of the percussion that's calling the shots here. The percussion snare drum stopped your cadence one bar before H. It looks like you dropped down to percussion 2 or something, but I show the snare drum continuing at that same sort of running cadence, but just at piano. Of arrival, but on the recording I think you'll hear the sound actually diminish just a little bit. A nice convincing finish, nicely choreographed, and memorized as well. Congratulations. Receiving some much deserved applause from the audience.
The girl that I'm playing the juggernaut of the film The Last of the Mohicans, I have to tell you, the greatest achievement in that whole performance, and I don't know that I've ever seen it done before, is the whole crowd stretched in a line right across the front, and they bowed together. How do you do that? I see just like quartets, and they stand up, and they come up bow together. What an achievement that is. Well done. Ladies and gentlemen, the Trinity Brass Band. Thank you. it's a big disappointment to you, but there are no Fuskers to go on stage now. I know it's a big off. However, you can sit here and watch people with timpani around the stage. You can even get the exciting thing of people counting how many cells that they're on, and that there's one for every chair, and then coming back and deciding they've got it wrong, and adding one, and then they decide that they've got enough. Or you can do nothing for 10 minutes. Move